Welcome to Tales from the Fourth Trimester, a podcast dedicated to the beauty and brutality of new motherhood. I'm your host, Naomi Chrysalakis, and I'm a postpartum doula and cook in Sydney, Australia. My service, Cocoon, provides good food and a helping hand for new mamas. Join me as I chat to women about what happened after they brought their baby home and interview experts for their wisdom. Because giving birth is just the beginning. Welcome to Tales from the Fourth Trimester. Today I am joined by Rachel Hollinger, who is a fellow postpartum doula, but she's over the other side of the world in America. I really loved this chat with Rachel, in part because I feel like she's kind of one of my colleagues. I have these, postpartum doulas spread around the country and the world who I either know through because we did the same training or I follow them on Instagram, but it feels like we're all part of a community doing similar work and supporting each other. It was so nice to actually sit down and have a really good chat with Rachel. But quite apart from my selfish wants of chatting to her, we talked about all the things in postpartum that we would love to see women doing for themselves, how we'd like to see community caring for them, partners supporting them, friends supporting them, food we want to see them eating, all the things. This is just two postpartum doulas sitting down and banging on about, what the state of postpartum care is like at the moment and what we would just love to see for women and the difference that it can make. So if you're curious about what a postpartum doula can do for you, or you're maybe interested in doing it for yourself, as in, becoming a postpartum doula, or you're just a friend who has a friend who's having a baby and you want to get some great ideas about how you can support them, I hope you find this podcast helpful. Today I've got Rachel Hollinger with me, who is joining me all the way from Pennsylvania. It's my Saturday morning, her Friday night. Thank you so much for giving up your Friday evening to chat to me, Rachel.
Yeah, absolutely.
Rachel and I are both graduates of the same postpartum doula training, and I've been following Rachel for ages because I just absolutely love what she does. She's got a strong focus on food. Like I do, but she's way more professional about it, as you'll hear
from. Oh, no.
Yes, you are. And she's actually got a fantastic e-cookbook. If anyone's looking for postpartum recipes, it's really beautiful. So we'll talk about where you can find that down the track, but I highly recommend that. I always tell people to go and get it. And yeah, I just wanted to get you on, Rachel, so we could have a talk about the work that you're doing and give some advice for women in their postpartum. So welcome.
Yes. Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm such a fan of yours, and I have been since, I guess, I was introduced to you through Julia, and I feel like we're friends. So this is really great to have a longer chat.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're living, who you're living with, what you're doing.
So I live in Pennsylvania with my husband and my daughter. She's 4.5, my daughter Beatrice. And we live in a little farmhouse and got some chickens and a garden, and we are pretty much exist outside. If the weather's nice, we're out of the house. My husband works from home, which gives me a lot of flexibility to do this work, which I'm really thankful for. And I work as a postpartum doula and chef for women in the fourth trimester. So that just means, anyone listening to this podcast knows what that means, but those first 40 days when, mama is home with the baby, she's, welcoming a child, but she's welcoming in this new version of herself, which is kind of the portion that I want to clue in on. I'm really centered on mother care. I'm there to support her in baby care, of course, but I think that the huge problem in postpartum care is that it's really centered on baby and breastfeeding and running the vacuum. And I wanted, when I started out, I wanted to focus on the mother, like mind, spirit, body, all of that. So that's what I do through food as medicine, birth processing, body work, which could be like massage or herbal care, that kind of stuff, breastfeeding support, sleep support, all of that kind of stuff. But it's super detailed and nuanced depending on what each woman needs, you know, because we're all on a different path in motherhood. So, so that's what I do. And then I facilitate a mother's circle and do some teaching and some writing and I have a cookbook. So yeah.
You're a busy lady.
Yes. And I have decided to homeschool my daughter this year. So that is, yeah. So I have been keeping a lot of plates spinning. So in a lot of ways, this season of staying home is needed.
Yeah.
Really, really, really needed for me.
You know, I always had this little dream of like homeschooling and, you know, Steiner Montessori, and Margot has been home from preschool with me like every single day, not going to grandparents, none of that, every single day. And I'm like, no, it's not for me.
My word. Even as a mother who's homeschooling, this is so much more intense.
Yeah.
What's happening right now is so intense, and I have
can't
found
go
myself,
anywhere, right?
Right, right. And so it's, and normally there's much more of like a village helping me to pull this off. And I have like large portions of the day out of the house. So it's a lot.
I just wanted to go back to something that you were saying before, which I think is a really excellent point about it being mother focused, the work that you do, and me too. I think, I often get inquiries from people who really, they need an au pair. They really need a postpartum doula, but what they're looking for is really an au pair or, a cleaner or a babysitter or, you know, a nanny. And I value all of those roles. Those are really important people to have in your village. But a postpartum doula is really quite different. It's not about we can say here is how you bath the baby, but it is so much about helping women ease into motherhood, whether it's the first time or the fourth time, because it's hard and it's a rebirth and it's not just entirely pragmatic or practical. It's emotional. Mm-hmm. I'm not a religious person, but I think it's kind of, it's definitely personal growth. Like there's so much that goes on during that matrescence sort of phase. So yeah, I think that's a really good point to make about the work that we're doing. It's sort of taking the focus back to the mother, because you know, you think about pregnancy, it's all about how are you feeling and how is, you know, it's the baby's, you know, along for the ride. And then as soon as the baby comes out, it's all about the baby. And, you know, of course the baby is important and we've got to look after that beautiful new life. But yeah, I see so much that women sort of feel forgotten about or just that their needs don't matter anymore. Like as long as they're okay, as long as the baby's okay, they're okay. Like, well, I had a healthy baby, so I should be fine. That sort of, you know, and it makes me sad.
And I think that women now, and especially, and I don't know, I think especially in my area, I live in a really conservative area. It's not just that they feel that way. I think they've completely bought into that mindset, in that women don't really believe that they deserve to be cared for that way after birth. And it's really, and it is looked at as, you know, a luxury. And, I think that I kind of joke about it being like the silent killer of postpartum, in that, you know, of course there's going to be a lot of really difficult physical issues that we encounter, or, you know, postnatal mood disorders and things like that. But truly where a lot of those things are stemming from, I think, is this belief that women, you know, that being a mother isn't a career and it just sort of, it happens overnight, literally. So I should adjust I should be able to take that on overnight. And that's just not true. And so I think half of my job is sort of swimming upstream in convincing women that, you know, that's not true about yeah. yourself. And it's also like, and we could go like really deep with this here, but I think that it's really hard because, you know, when the feminist movement happened, it was pretty angry, you know, it was angry and women wanted rights and women wanted to be in the workplace. And then, and it was very much like, you know, looking down on the homemaker sort of, mm-hmm. and then it swung really hard to, then it was like, oh, anything that's women's work isn't good enough either. Mm-hmm. So now I think women are trying to find this balance between those two things. You know, is it yeah. still a career if I'm staying home and taking care of this baby? Is it enough? And women don't feel like it is. And so I think I'm constantly trying to help women find this balance of you do what makes you happy. You know, if baby goes in daycare and you need to get back to some sort of structure or creativity, you should do that, but you should also respect that those first few weeks and look at them as, you know, still really valuable as a woman.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I have strong feelings about all of that stuff because I am a staunch feminist and I was a staunch feminist. And, you know, that idea that we can do anything that men can do. Mm-hmm. And then I feel like I had my baby and I was like, hang on a second. If I want mm-hmm. to exclusively breastfeed, like if you want to, you know, there are different ways of doing it, but if you want to exclusively breastfeed, if you want to, you know, have that sort of primary carer role, it is really bloody hard as a woman yep. to do. It's not equal. It really isn't. It's mm. very different for a guy who can, you know, come and go to work and have fun times with the baby and change a nappy. And that's kind of, I mean, that's not it, but you know, it's just different. Yeah. And in a way I felt a bit betrayed by this concept that, yeah, you know, we can have it all and we should have it all and we should mm. be able to do everything at the same time, you know, this kind of, I think it sets us up for this really stressful period of, well, I should yeah. be able to, I mean, it's different here. It's just in the States, we legally, like we get 4 months of government parental leave paid for, and then we get, yeah, I mean, it's minimum wage, but it's better than nothing. And then we might yeah. get something from our employer as well. And legally they have to hold our jobs for a year. So it's pretty common for women to take mm-hmm. 6 months off, a year off. I had 7 months wow. off myself before going back 2 days a week. So it's different, but there is this sort of, you know, even with a small, like an infant, this idea that, well, I should be okay getting back to work. I know so all of my friends who've had babies have had to deal with this push-pull thing between, I want to stay at home, but I feel guilty. I should be financially contributing because that's what, you know, as feminists, you know, like, oh, it's, mm-hmm. I mean, we could talk for hours about this, but.
It's confusing. Tricky. I mean, I think it's almost like women are, you know, very much in the fast lane of especially in the US, I feel like it's that superwoman. Mm-hmm. I can do it all. I get a gold star if I'm back at Pilates the fastest, you know, after I've had a baby, mm-hmm. all of those things. And that is the image of motherhood
yes.
that's portrayed. It's either that or it's, I haven't washed my hair in 6 days. I'm just drinking wine and scraps of bread. Yeah, like I'm just a complete mess of a person. Yeah. And it's, women look at that and they definitely don't want to not wash their hair for 6 days. So then they choose the superwoman approach. And I'm here to tell women that, like, you don't have to be either one of those things. You know, you can find a balance. You can make this your own. And it's really important to honor what's going on during that fourth trimester period, because we don't, it comes back to bite us, you know, in trauma attaches to trauma. It's never, we never really move past something until we allow ourselves to. So it's just really, really important to respect that, I think. Yes. And here women, you know, usually are required to return back to work between 6 to 12 weeks. So it's just, it's heartbreaking. I mean, I have like watched so many mothers just really grieve through that process. I mean, can you imagine even leaving your 6 week old? It's crazy.
No, I couldn't have left my 6 week old, literally. She would not have left.
Right. And pumping in bathrooms and all of this crazy stuff. So it's just, it's so hard. So yeah, I'm trying to bridge that divide for women, and I'm hoping that I'm doing that. I think I do for many, but you do have to get on board with this new mindset of doing things the feminine way when you've been used to doing things the masculine way.
Yeah.
In order to be respected, you know, as a woman. So
tell us a little bit about your background, because I know you've got a food background.
Mm-hmm. I do have a food background. So I, before I had my daughter, let's go back a little further. I have a degree in culinary arts. That was my college degree. And then after school, I worked in restaurants for a little while. That was very intense. I don't know how people have families and work in restaurants. It's just like you sell your soul. So I did that for a little bit, and then I transitioned to catering, and then I transitioned to personal chef work. And that's sort of like, oh, okay. Felt like a little bit more like home for me. So I did that up until I was pregnant with my daughter. And I love that. I did like some recipe development for a pie company that was like super fun. Oh, that was like one of my favorite jobs. Basically just got to like make pie and eat pie all day long. Yeah, it was great. And did like, just like for cookbooks and things like that, did some recipe development. I loved that. So I was doing that. And then, my husband and I had only been married for about 6 months, and my daughter was a surprise. Mm-hmm. I had had a ton of like hormone issues up until then. So I was having trouble with that anyway. And then, you know, whoopsie daisy, here she comes. So that really like brought things to a halt in a natural sense. But then, during pregnancy, I was diagnosed with HG, hyperemesis. Oh, yeah. And so pregnancy was, it was hell. And sometimes I feel like I'm not allowed to say that, but I am. It was really, really dark. It was really, really difficult. I was on bed rest for the whole 9 months. In and out of the hospital for IVs. I couldn't hardly stand without passing out. So I had to crawl. I mean, it was horrid. So, I had a lot of time in bed, you know, obviously just kind of staring at the ceiling, thinking about everything, thinking about what I was doing previously to this and what I wanted to do moving forward. And that sort of started this inkling of me knowing that I wanted to use food to connect with people. And I didn't know that that was women really at the time. I just had that thought. So then I had my daughter. It was a really, really difficult, traumatic labor. And I had like a lot of complications. So I had an additional 3 months on bed rest postpartum because she fractured my tailbone. So I had some issues from that. And
was she a big baby, or was it just her position?
It was just her position. She wasn't, she was just very average in size. And I just labored for a long time. So they're thinking it was just the way she was staying there. So I know. So all of this, you know, I was obviously really, really dark and really, really difficult, but think if there's anything that I've learned about myself and honestly all women, is that when women are given, you know, suffering in that way, it is very natural for us to translate that into empathy and more connection. And I think, you know, we were talking about this before, like there are many women who are in postpartum work who they are doing that work because they had some sort of challenge or traumatic experience or that led them to that. So yeah, in that postpartum period of just trying to heal and experiencing really the whole in our healthcare regarding postpartum support and health, I just started searching around for answers and Googling things and reading books and trying to figure out, my goodness, I cannot be the only person feeling this way. You know, why did nobody tell me this is going to be this hard? And I came across Julia's work and completely fell in love, because up until then I had been looking at like the American sort of Association of Doulas. They have their basic postpartum course, and I'm looking through the coursework thinking, where is there anything about the mother in here? This this is crazy. It's all baby stuff. And then of course, look at, you know, training to look for signs of postpartum depression, but I'm like, couldn't we get there before that happened? So I found Julia's work and decided to go through her program. And it was very clear that this was the perfect marriage of food and connection for me. And it was truly like I had found my life's work. Like it was this like shining firework moment. So I've just been furthering my education here and there ever since. And I took a few more nutrition classes because I was really interested in that, and Ayurvedic food, and herbalism. And then I'm just starting to get into some more like lactation stuff and vaginal steaming, which I've been very interested in. So, I feel like there's a million, rabbit trails with this kind of work. We can just keep learning and So I've been doing that ever since.
Tell me a little bit about what your postpartum period was like with your daughter. Did you have any specific challenges?
Yeah, I did. So, I mean, aside from the tailbone situation, I had a third degree tear, and a prolapsed bladder. So there was just like all kinds of like just really intense pressure and pain, that was making it really hard for me to really move around or do anything. Which is why I kind of stayed in bed a little bit longer. I think aside from all of the pain and trying to figure out how to breastfeed, it was really like that sense of isolation that got me in the end. You have people come and drop some meals off, but how long does that last? You know, maybe the first couple of weeks. And I remember not really knowing, no one had given me permission to really ask for help at that point. I didn't really know that that was something that I should do. And I remember calling one of my friends and asking if they would bring me a chocolate pie, because I didn't know what I needed. I just thought maybe chocolate pie would like fix something.
That sounds like a cure-all for everything.
I did cover a multitude of things, but they were like, oh yeah, of course, yes. And they brought it and they dropped it off, and you know, they kind of said hey to the baby and then they left again. And I was sitting there with this chocolate pie on the balcony. We lived in like a really tiny apartment at the time, you know, holding my baby, eating the chocolate pie, literally out of the tin, and feeling like I was no better off. And then I think that was really a moment of me realizing that what women really needed was connection. Like, well, I wasn't even like, I knew what I wanted them to do. I just wanted them to stay, you know, just to be there, and hold some space for me to talk or cry or, yeah, or whatever else. And my husband's amazing and, you know, served me tirelessly, but he's not a woman. And so there was so much of that, that I just feel like he didn't know what to do with. He had no idea what to do with me. So I was really sad. And I did go to therapy after that. After, I think it was like month three, I finally was like, okay, this is not getting better. So, and then I was diagnosed with postpartum depression and PTSD, from labor. I was having really intense nightmares, and just really like not moving past it. And it has taken, I don't think I fully felt like comfortable in my own body again until my daughter was almost three. It just took a long time. And the work that I do was really healing to me in a lot of ways. To watch other women be able to overcome that, to feel like I had a part in that, was really hopeful and empowering to me. So that was definitely part of it. Mm. But yeah, now she's 4 and a half and I'm like, okay, should I ever do this again? So I'm twiddling my thumbs a little bit. But yeah, it was hard and it was dark, but I'm really thankful for it. I never would have found this work without it. And yeah, I can't imagine doing anything else for the rest of my life. So that's a good silver lining.
Absolutely. I feel the same way. And I didn't have as big birth dramas as that, but yes, it took me a long time to feel ready to have another baby. And yeah, Margot's going to be four when the baby comes. So yeah, it's pretty decent. Yeah.
And you don't even necessarily have to have big birth traumas. You know, I feel like women I sometimes hesitate to give like my birth story and my background to women, because it feels like what it does is immediately diminishes their own experience, which might not have sounded as big or dramatic, but I think it's really important to remember for each individual woman that, you know, her whatever looks like trauma to that woman only looks like trauma to that woman, you know, and what was difficult for me may not have been difficult for you or for another woman. And it's really important just not to compare at all, you know.
So tell us a bit about how you would typically work with women. At what point do people tend to kind of reach out to you and book you in, and what does that look like from there for you?
So I mean, I've had a wide range of women coming to, like, some women are like super super on top of their game and they're like in the first trimester are reaching out to me. Most women I reach through teaching, and I think I've found that is I had to learn at first that this was only going to happen with education on the front end, because it's so new. And most women here don't even know that postpartum doulas are a thing. In fact, when I tell people what I do, they ask me how many births I've attended, like, immediately after. I'm like, no, I just said I work with women after. So I teach a lot of workshops and things like that. And I often have women just book with me on the spot after those. So that happens, but then now it's just like word of mouth, because I've worked with a lot of women in this area that now it's just friends, or women now having second and thirds. And so that's really beautiful, because now I feel like I've woven in a community around here, and that's really great. But I also work with women remotely. So I've had women as far as, I think my farthest was Vienna. I worked with a woman there. Yeah. And so, and I actually have a few remote clients right now, which is mostly what I've been doing at home. So yeah, and then once I'm working with a mother, you know, for in person, which is what I really, really love to do. It looks like I usually work for 6 to 8 weeks, with a mother, and, we will start out. Usually each visit is around like 3 hours. I might see her 2 or 3 times a week, depending on her need. And then, it is a wide range of things, always food. We usually sit down for tea and just sort of, I always say like do a download, of what's going on with her and her mind and her heart and her body. So that I can figure out what needs to be done that day. And then I'll get in the kitchen. I usually do like a main dish, a couple snacks and a couple beverages, like herbal teas or things like that. And I'll do it in pretty big batches because if there's one pet peeve of mine, it's that women don't eat enough. Mm-hmm. It's like, I mean, you can eat the right things and then still not eat enough of them. And it's, you're in the same spot. So, I really encourage women to snack. And so I like to have her fridge really well stocked. And I'll usually put a box or a basket or something by her nursing chair, you know, like some dates with tahini inside or, you know, just little things she can pop, while she's nursing. So, I'll do that. And then we'll usually have the last hour of the visit for, you know, body work. I do some massage, often like an herbal bath, maybe she'll take a nap, while I wear the baby. I have this knack for getting every baby to sleep except my own. I don't know. Like my daughter was a terrible sleeper, and like the moms will hand their babies to me and I'll just get them right down and they'll be like, oh my word, what in the world? And it's like, I have this internal frustration. Like, why can't I swear babies just read off of our stress. And I think it's because I don't need that baby to sleep that night.
I find the same thing. I can't say that I have 100% success rate, but I find it, you know, pretty easy to get other babies to sleep.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of another, I mean, I can't remember a time that I've had any major dramas.
Yeah.
But my own baby was a nightmare. But I think
it's terrible.
I think it was probably, you know, feeding off the anxiety that I definitely had. And I had a lot of stress around the sleep situation. That was something that I really focused on. And I was like very angsty over naps, and she was a cat napper and she only wanted to sleep on me. And I was like, why is she not sleeping in the bassinet for 2 hours like other babies? And
which is a total misconception to begin with. Cause we think, all babies are doing that. No, they're not. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the way it goes. But honestly, a lot of it is me sort of giving little pushes and little hints for mama to feel like she is making her own decisions and moving with confidence. Just like what we were just talking about, you know, does she have to sleep in the bassinet for 2 hours? And even just putting that question out there is sometimes enough for them to be like, oh, I don't know. Why do I think that? Who told me that was supposed to be true? That's kind of what it looks like. And then by the end of 6 to 8 weeks, we are best friends and we never want to leave each other ever again. So I have like huge separation anxiety. And so I try to work with only one or two mamas at a time. So it's usually about one mother a month because I get so emotionally invested. It's hard for me to do more than that.
I find it hard to keep up with the, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on with them emotionally and in their lives. And I did have a period last year where I was looking after four women. It was just because some babies arrived late and some arrived early, and it was a crossover. And I really had to get kind of good at, like, I had to write notes for myself because otherwise I couldn't keep track of what was happening with every mom.
Exact same. I guess it was this past fall, I had four mothers at one time at one point for the same reason, just, you know, due dates are not totally predictable. Mm-hmm. I had post-its everywhere, had reminders on my phone, and I just, like, was a complete mess. It was too much, and burnout too, you know. It can be really emotionally heavy work. And I think I learned a lesson from that, in that in order to properly hold space for the mother, I have to have space. And I didn't have any space left. I was feeling super burnout. So I try to just keep it to one or two now. But yeah.
What are your favorite foods to make for new moms?
Oh my goodness, it's hard. I am a snack girl. And I think that all new mothers should be snack girls. I think it's like the way that we survive is just to keep eating. So I tend to gravitate towards, you know, like the dates with tahini is one of my really favorite things to do. I have an oxytocin chocolate bar that I make, which is kind of fun to keep on hand.
Is that in the cookbook? I'm trying to remember.
It's not in the cookbook. No, it's not.
Rachel, actually, I want that a recipe for myself.
I'll send it to you. I actually just keep coming up with recipes. So I'm thinking about maybe, I don't know what it's going to look like, but maybe do another volume or release a print copy with like more recipes or something like that. So we'll see, because I just keep thinking of things. It's never ending. This is in my cookbook, but it's a stewed fruit with chai spiced custard poured over top. And I really like things like that are very, this doesn't sound necessarily appetizing, but watery, you know, soups and stews and porridge, and that's the stewed fruit and custard. It's just very, you know, sometimes I'll even do like granola with homemade applesauce or things like that, that are just really soft and soothing. You can eat with a spoon out of a mug, or something like that. So, I gravitate towards those types of things. And of course I have, you know, herbs that I like to work in, that I think they're medicinally helpful, but I also like to add that romantic quality to food. So I think like rose and lavender and chamomile and calendula and all of those really beautiful flowers are, they are healing as a fact, but there is something about seeing them in your food or tasting those floral notes that I feel like is really healing to mothers. So yeah. I like working with those too.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
And of course the Ayurvedic side of things is all about moist, watery, stewy, warming food. So yeah, that's kind of, that's what I try and do as well.
Yeah. And warming in a lot of ways too. I think women sometimes feel like, so I have to have like steaming hot everything, but I like to point them in the direction, especially mamas giving birth in summertime, where it's like, please don't make me drink a cup of steaming tea. Got this like little hot heater of a baby laying on top of me. So that can come through spices, you know, we can find a lot of our warmth there, or by just sticking to room temperature rather than cold, you know. So if you're going to make a smoothie, just don't throw ice in it or whatever. It's doable.
It is doable, but yes, it is summer babies are more of a challenge if you want to eat in that way, but I try and do like a roasted root vegetable salad on a base of like hummus, you know, with a tahini dress, like that sort of thing. Like it's cooked.
Yeah.
So you know, it's not, it's not like I love big, crunchy raw salads. Like that's one of my favorite things to eat, but it's not not in postpartum in summer if you can possibly help it.
No, I know. And you can get veggies so many, and you don't have to cook them to death. I think that's something that people often just cook them and cook them and cook them. And then there really is no element of freshness left. Yeah. And all that to say that, you couldn't do like coconut rice with an egg and some microgreens or something like that on top that still makes you feel like you're getting, you know, that garden feeling. There's ways.
Yeah, there are ways, always. Oh gosh, what was I? It just went out of my head. I just wanted to ask you what you see. Excuse me, I've gone all croaky. What you see happening with what are the kind of common issues, challenges that you see arising with your clients in that postpartum phase? I mean, breastfeeding seems to be the biggest one for me. I know that's
breastfeeding, but I would even say and this is my tendency, is to bring everything, even physical issues, back to an emotional place. Because, you know, we know that our emotions are linked to our bodies. Our bodies manifest things according to how we're feeling. So I think that a lot of the challenge behind breastfeeding is often, you know, women just not really feeling like they have anyone in their corner, saying that their decisions are okay, or, you know, often I cannot tell you how many times I've come over to a mom's house and she's sitting there crying while she's breastfeeding, and because she has to end her journey and now she's going to have to supplement with formula because baby doesn't weigh enough. And she's just been to the pediatrician and who has told her all of these things. Now you should see a pediatrician. They're great people. They're doing great work. But I think that, again, this is just a cultural shift that has to happen in believing the mother, and allowing her to follow her instinct. I think that it's sort of written off as wishy-washy and almost new age type of vibe to it of, you know, is a mother's intuition a real thing? And I really believe that it is. Mm. And that as healthcare professionals, we should be paying attention to it. It should be factored in. So I think women often struggle with breastfeeding because they have been told that something's wrong with them, that they can't do it normally, or that they have to do it differently than the way that they really want to do it. And maybe sometimes that might be true, but I think that they should be given the chance to try, you know, to just try it the way that they want to do it and learn from experience. And if it goes okay, then wow, what a victory. So I had a mother one time who I was sitting next to her on the couch and she was using this nipple shield and she was so angry and frustrated at this nipple shield. And she was crying and I don't want to use this. I feel like, you know, I feel like I can't do this right. And there's milk going everywhere and keeps falling off. And, so I sort of just gently asked her, why are you using the nipple shield? And she said, well, it's because the doctor told me I had to use it. And I said, okay, why did he think you had to use it? And she was like, I don't know. He said my nipples weren't the right shape. And I said, okay, have you tried not using it? Do you want to try not using it? And she was it was like she was fearful to do that. And I said, you don't have to, but I'm just giving you permission that if you want to try nursing your baby without that, you can. And she did. And within 24 hours, she never used it again. She was completely fine. And she was, and it was like something so simple that when we're talking about it later, she started crying again and was just saying, I think it wasn't about the nipple shield. It was like, I felt this deep sense of I'm not good enough for my baby. My body isn't doing what it's supposed to be doing. I'm the wrong shape. I'm the wrong size. I can't do this right. And she needed just permission to do it her way, no matter what shape her nipples were, you know? Yeah. And I think that it's really important to give women that kind of permission.
Totally. And it's so interesting how this is the way our culture is set up, to see the external authority
yes.
as the expert. And I mean, there are, those people are there for a reason and they're amazing, yeah. but I 100% agree. It's so easy as a new mum. You don't know what you're doing. It's a learning, it's a very steep learning curve. And it's much more natural for us now, because of cultural reasons, to put all of our trust into some, you know, whether it's a sleep expert or a pediatrician or, and right.
That, right.
But I think that completely overrides your own instincts. And mm-hmm. it's hard, because at the start, I mean, I remember people being like, well, listen to your instincts. I was like, I don't have any. I don't know. I don't know what my instincts are. Just someone needs to tell me what sleep. I'm going to go and buy a book. And I did. And
I know.
It didn't fucking work. But, you know, like.
We just want the answer or the magic pill or something. You are in a state of desperation. It's completely understandable. I felt the same exact way, and I ate up every little bit of information anyone would give me. I read all the books. Yeah. I took anything anyone says was the next godsend. You know, it was going to rescue me. The thing about intuition for a mother is that it is a very quiet voice. So if there's a lot of noise, you cannot hear that voice. Yeah. And I think that it's really important to alleviate. Okay, stop reading some of the books and get off the online forums and stop Googling your symptoms and, you know, all of those things.
Watching the clock.
Oh my word, yes. And just try it for like 48 hours. Just try it and see what surfaces there when you have eliminated some of that white noise.
Yeah. But just going back to breastfeeding, because I think that seems to be one of the biggest, or feeding in general.
Yeah.
And you know, when I have people talking to me when I do postpartum planning sessions, a lot of it is around, you know, will I be able to breastfeed, or I had a hard time breastfeeding and how can I make it better this time? Mm-hmm. You did a really great series on mastitis and blocked ducts, which I always tell people about. Do you want to tell people what your recommendations are for if they're having blocked ducts, which could lead to mastitis? I mean, talking about the emotional connection, I personally, I'm always like, this is always, always, always a sign from your body that you are doing too much and you need to rest. Yeah. And that is absolutely the number one thing. And it's also if you're still bleeding, if your bleeding gets heavier, that's another sure sign. Like, put your feet up.
And it's good that our bodies are giving us these signs, or else we would never know. I mean, a woman's healing postpartum is internal. You know, we have an internal wound where the placenta has detached. That's about the size of a dinner plate. That's massive. And I think that's why it's easy to sort of, we can't see it. So, except for if we're bleeding. So it's really easy to think, okay, well, I get even 6 weeks out, I guess things are normal. But I always describe it to women as like a scab. Like if you scrape yourself and it heals over into a scab on your elbow, but then you bend your elbow, it's going to break back open. And it's going to start bleeding. And that the placenta wound is exactly like that. And in terms of mastitis, you're right. It's that. There are supplements you can take and there are things you can do and things like that. But again, if you're not resting, none of that counts. So the number one thing is to realize that you've done a little bit too much and back up off of that, lay down and just super take it easy, like extreme, take it easy. It's going to feel like you're being crazy about it, but really don't do anything except eat and sleep and lay in bed.
And take your hot drinks and your lecithin and your.
Yep. So sunflower lecithin is really easy. What that does is it thins your milk out. So women that are prone to clogs usually have a higher, like a really fatty milk, so it's really, really thick. And so that can help. I usually tell women to do like 2 capsules in the day and in the morning and 2 capsules in the evening, to keep up on that. And doing that, you can do that just preventatively for your entire breastfeeding, like as long as you want to do that. I personally would, like if I were to get pregnant again, I would start taking it day one, like before my milk even comes in, just to have that, just to know that I have a tendency towards that as a woman. So I would do that. And then temperature is definitely your friend. So if you've got a clog, you got to get it out. And there's a lot of, like, if you Google it, you're going to hear a lot of, you know, get an electric toothbrush and take the back of the electric toothbrush and really dig in there and all that stuff. Please don't do that. It's so harsh to your breast tissue. That is so tender. You can really, really bruise yourself. And actually, the more that you mess with the clog, the more inflamed it's going to become around it. And that essentially just holds it in place, because now it's just swollen. So what you want to do is ice for 20 minutes after you've fed your baby. So get the breast empty, ice for 20 minutes, and then heat it up again for 20 minutes before you feed. So basically you're reducing all the inflammation, and then you're warming it so it's like really soft and can flow back out before your baby sucks again. And by toggling between those two things, it will eventually loosen by reducing that inflammation. It'll come out. And that is pretty foolproof. I've gotten 5 or 6 clogs out that way myself, and most of my mothers, once we use that, it's usually out within like 36 hours. Yeah. So that is really effective. And again, just keeping the breast empty. Just try to keep it empty. I mean, most women who are getting mastitis have oversupply.
Right. Or are not doing, you know, they're following some kind of, like I remember my mom being like, well, you're feeding her too long. When I was feeding her for like 45 minutes, she was like, I was always told 10 minutes and 10 minutes and then another 10 minutes. And I was like, and how many times did you get mastitis, mom? And she got mastitis a lot.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah. I mean, not that I knew what I was really doing. I was just like, the baby, that's how long it's taking. I don't know.
Unfortunately,
I had a block duct a couple of times, but I didn't ever get it. Yeah.
Well, and if you can get it out soon enough, then it often doesn't turn into anything.
Yeah.
And you'll know. You'll know if mastitis is coming on. You'll have fever and you'll feel like you're coming down with the flu. but I think, again, that's a really great thing to come back to, because that's another way in which women are very much put in like one size fits all postpartum. Your baby can feed for 5 minutes. Your baby might feed for 45 minutes. And so once we sort of take all these like very strict parameters off of postpartum and baby care, there's a lot more freedom from fear, honestly. I mean, that it holds women in complete terror. They're doing everything wrong. So yeah. And if you do have oversupply, you're going to feed for a while, you know, you gotta empty that out. And, and if not, then just pump the excess off afterwards, so you can keep the breast empty.
And even if it's not an oversupply thing, it could just be, you know, your baby's just takes longer, like, or has a tongue tie, or has, you know, there's all,
yeah.
And yeah, it's just,
that's why it's so helpful to have robots. Somebody around. Yeah. Baby is not a robot, and you are not expected to know everything. That's why it's just really helpful to have someone there to read the red flags and look under your baby's tongue and, or tell you that, oh no, that's totally fine. I wouldn't worry about that. You know, let you off the hook a little bit.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. The other big thing that comes up for people that I work with is kind of this balance between getting good support, but also having boundaries. Because I think it's like you want,
yeah.
You want support. And it's really such a fine line. Mm-hmm. And I don't always have all the answers, but is that something that you come up against too?
Oh my word. Yes. It's so hard. It's so hard because most of the time the boundaries have to be with family, and that is uncomfortable. So I think something that I try to guide the mother towards is to get a little bit creative with the ways that those people can still support you, those triggering people, we'll call them. because not everyone is a good support person postpartum, you know? And I just was meeting with one of my remote clients today, and she was talking about this, and I said, I just want to give you permission to curate your postpartum visitors. You know, you're allowed to do that, right? And she was like, I don't know if I knew I was allowed to do that. And I think if something is sacred and precious to you, as postpartum is, then you should be allowed to protect that. So, in terms of people who might be triggering, you know, negative emotions or feelings of not enough or not doing things the right way or all of that, or people, you know, who offer help, but you know, there's a million strings attached. Those kinds of people can still serve you and, you know, be part of your team. It's just going to look a little bit different. So I've had mothers, you know, let's be real. It's usually the mother-in-law.
Yeah. I was going to say it's the grandmothers, right?
Yeah. So that's the person, but of course that's also the person who wants to be there the most.
Yeah.
And so
if harnessed properly, can actually be hugely helpful.
Yes, absolutely. But you have to give the right kinds of things. This sounds very strategical as I'm saying this, but it's the truth. And you do have to be a little bit strategical in order to protect, create the environment that you are longing for. So some things I've had suggested that mother-in-laws do before is like, can you come pick up all my laundry Wednesday every week, take it to your house and do it there, and then come drop it off, like, you know, the laundry fairy that you are. And also putting this in language that makes that person feel really valued, because it isn't that they're not, you know. And then maybe when you come back, we could have, you know, I have 15 minutes, and maybe we could get some baby snuggles while I go take a shower. So you're limiting the interaction with that person that's becoming triggering. But that person also still feels like they have a place and a job to do, and that they're valued in your motherhood journey, and that you can get really creative with that. There's all different kinds of things that mother-in-laws can do that are out of the house. I mean, grocery shopping, that's huge. And even right now, you know, with everyone staying at home, there's all kinds of porch drop-off options, laundry and groceries and all that.
Laundry was a good one. And that's something, because I'm thinking about, what will I do if I can't have any visitors, including there was a time when it was looking like my parents would not be helping us, and now there's like, okay, I think they will be helping us. But yeah, mm-hmm. Laundry, meal train, that was another thing.
Yeah, meal trains. If there's any outdoor like work to do, I've had moms recently, I've suggested that, you know, if you have a garden, somebody come weed your garden once a week.
Yeah.
Mow the lawn, you know, that's all stuff that you don't want, that's too strenuous. You know, walking dogs.
Yeah.
Even doing food pickup, take out and bringing it. Anything that you don't have to leave your bed is still really helpful. And of course, you know, our partners are experiencing way more of a workload, so to speak, during this time, and that is just the way it is. You really have to clue in with your your partner and figure out how you're going to pull this off together, because you're going to have to lean on each other a lot more. But I do think there's a lot of ways that our communities can support mothers during this time.
Absolutely. And I think what I like about what you're saying as well is that there's people who are great for the practical side of things.
Mm-hmm.
And then you might not be able to have those trusted women come and sit with you and hold that space, but we have technology, which means that we can mm-hmm. still, so if you can't have those visitors, you know, you can still jump on a Zoom call or a FaceTime and, you know,
absolutely.
Do it that way to have that kind of emotional support. Yeah. As well.
I'm running my mother's circle virtually right now, which was a big learning curve for me. And I was really skeptical at first, like this just isn't going to be as valuable. But it's been great. I mean, we all look forward to it every week. It's just nice to laugh and to cry. And we talk about the same things. We're the same women. And I've also recommended, there's an app, I don't know, maybe you use it already, called Marco Polo. And I don't know if you have it there. I'm assuming that you would. It's almost like a walkie-talkie. A video walkie-talkie where you record it, and it's like in real time. Like you can watch each other live, but you can go back and forth. And so I've had a lot of my mothers using that because it feels much more like the person is in the room with you. You can do a quick check-in. You don't have to schedule a time and you know, have a big sit down, but you can just prop it up and say, oh, hey, I'm nursing right now, but this came to my mind and I just wonder what you thought about it. You know, it's just nice to have little bits of each other's lives. So that's been really how I've had quite a few mothers say, oh my word, this has changed the game for me, and just feeling like I have community. But check in with mama still.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's something that, I think is really important. It's great to do, you know, the drop-offs, but people still need that connection and that contact.
Yeah. And you can process, I mean, I'm still processing birth and things like that with my clients remotely. So you can do all of that. If you can find a safe person who you feel comfortable being vulnerable with, there's lots of, you know, therapists doing calls virtually. So all of those things are still available to us. We just have to be a little bit more creative.
Yes, we do.
Yeah.
Oh, thanks, Rachel. Now tell everyone before we finish up where they can find you.
Yeah. So my business name is Nourish Her. And my Instagram handle is Nourish Her Doula. My website is nourishherdoula.com. And you can also find my cookbook. It's for sale on my website, and learn more about packages and working with me remotely or Mother Circle or any of that kind of stuff on there.
Great. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with us all. It's really great to have you on.
Oh, thanks for having me on. I'm really honored to speak with you. You're doing amazing things, and it's really encouraging to connect with other women in postpartum work all over the world. I'm really excited about the change that's coming from others, for sure.
Me too. Thanks, Rachel. Thank you so much for listening to Tales from the Fourth Trimester. I appreciate each and every one of you who listens, shares, rates and reviews and does all of those things, tells a friend, the works. If you'd like to connect with me, you can head on over to Instagram or Facebook at Cocoon by Naomi is where you can find me. You can head to my website, which is www.cocoonbynaomi.com. Thanks, and see you next week.